Need another versus Commissioner of Highways, L. Stephen Emmer, Jeremy T. Hopkins, Brian T. Chin, Council, David Oakley, James Webb Jones, Mark Barberry, Attorney General, Jeffrey M. Moore, Deputy Attorney General, Travis Cox, Deputy Solicitor General, Jeffrey R. Allen, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Christopher D. I., Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appalachia.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and in this case, I represent the landowners in an eminent domain appeal. I believe that the issues are fairly well outlined in the brief, so I don't propose to go over my reply brief and say the same thing again. I think that it's fairly well established that we're talking about the interplay between three discrete and completely different steps in a condemnation process.
Can I ask you briefly, though, about your brief? Footnote 1 says the trial court learned that there was this nefarious practice going on. When I first read that, I thought it meant what it said, which is evidence came in, the trial court learned it. But when I found the transcript, the evidence was not evidence at all. It was just an exhibit drawn up after trial by then-trial counsel, and the court expressly rejected it.
Correct.
It wasn't offered at trial. So how did the trial court learn anything from evidence that wasn't before it?
It wasn't offered at trial because this wasn't an issue for the jury. It was to inform the trial court of the reason why the commission...
But the trial judge rejected the exhibit.
Correct, and it's in the record.
Well, my point is, evidence is rejected, arguments that are rejected. That means the trial court's saying it's not permissible. He said it was not permissible.
You're right, Your Honor. And he said the same thing about Exhibit 3, which is what we're here to argue about today, the statement itself. All those statements were excluded from evidence. They were all rejected. And that's why you'll find, for example, on Exhibit 3, the statement by Mr. Savage, the word that he rejected on the exhibit itself. The trial court clearly knew about this, and that's it's an illustration of what the principle is, that we're here to say, as I said at the writ stage, this is an abusive litigation tactic. I recall that Mr. Justice Goodwin was a little troubled by that when I said it. And I better back it up now that I have a few more minutes than I did at the
Ritz. The problem is, when that argument was made to the trial judge and then trial counsel presented the demonstrative exhibit that lawyers drew up, not witnesses, the trial judge said, this is improper, I'm not going to consider it.
Right. I understand.
Well, it is improper, and he was right not to consider it. Why are we talking about it now? Why was it argued in the brief?
It's an illustration, just as any other illustrative exhibit was to be. It wasn't evidence offered at trial. I clearly agree with that.
Was it evidence at all?
Yes, it was evidence. It was offered and rejected by the judge and placed in the record as a refused exhibit. That's the only way I can
Okay, well, normally if the judge refuses evidence and you don't assign error to the refusal, we don't consider it because it's not part of the record.
I understand that, and I'm not asking that you address the refusal of this as an exhibit. But I do think that it's something that illustrates the tactic that the commissioner is using. And that's the heart of my argument on that issue. And I acknowledge it's a sub-issue. It's not the main issue in this case. But what happens is in a quick-take situation like this, the commissioner is allowed to come in, deposit money, and as soon as the deposit hits the clerk's office, the commissioner owns the property. And he can literally go that afternoon to the landowner, knock on the door, and say, you need to get off my land. In exchange for this, the property owner is allowed to withdraw the funds so that he has something to go and perhaps buy a new house with. Or, as is all too often, if he has a mortgage, he must take that money and pay down the mortgage because the typical deed of trust has an acceleration clause for a condemnation proceeding. If there's a business, he may need the money to replace a loss of business. Landowners have that right, and the Ramseys exercise that right here. And what happened, of course, is that then the condemnor came up with another appraisal, indicated there were going to be a damage claim of $92,000, that was their testimony, and conveyed that if we win a trial, you're going to have to write us a check for the difference in that amount. And it's happening again and again by our government towards citizens who've done nothing wrong. It's just that their property was in the way.
Can I interrupt you there? Is it happening again and again? Courts don't declare other government branches in bad faith unless there's evidence of it. All we have is this record, this case. We don't have press clippings. We don't read the media. We don't hear emotional rhetoric. We decide it on the evidence. So what evidence is there in this case that there's some nefarious bad faith practice by VDOT to bait and switch the appraisals?
Exhibit 1 is the Ramseys. It happened in this case. An officer of the court is represented to the trial judge that it's happened again and again and again, and it's happened more since this case was tried. So that's what I'm trying to illustrate here, is the danger to our citizens and our commonwealth. But you don't have to accept my argument that it's happening again and again. You may reject that if you wish. I'm saying it in order to illustrate the point, the same point that the landowners attempted to make to the trial court, that this is an abusive litigation tactic. It's conceivable they may say, well, they can just leave the money in there and just not take that risk. That's kind of the Marie Antoinette approach. Let them eat cake. They can simply leave the money in and not have a place to live.
But can I ask you this?
I don't understand what you're just saying.
Well, the idea is that rich people can probably afford to leave the money in court and not take the risk that they would have to write a check for $150,000 to pay the money back if they lose a trial.
But this is what the statute provides.
It does. I understand that. But it doesn't allow the government to use the bludgeon of this litigation tactic in order to compel people to give up their right to jury trials.
That's
the
threat, like a jury trial argument to me, Mr. Emmert. The issue in the case is really quite simple. Whether or not this affidavit, this appraisal is within the general rule that is protected from disclosure unless it was made, to quote Nichols, other than for purposes of acquisitions, negotiations, and condemnation. Well, it was made for that purpose. Well, so the general rule is, frankly, quite settled.
Well, let me turn to that. I don't think it is settled at all, Your Honor, because the provision that we have is pursuant to the statute 205, and that does call for three discrete events. There is a statement that is made before any settlement offer is made. There is then an offer to purchase, and then if that's unsuccessful, there's a certificate, a deposit. In this situation, the conveyance of that statement was made before there was an offer. That's made abundantly clear by pages 85 and 86.
The 2011 amendment, which added that language before making an offer, does that apply to this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
But you quoted it before
negotiating for it.
You quoted it in your brief, so it doesn't apply.
No.
But you relied upon it.
Your Honor, the statute, even as it had appeared before 2011, required them to do this before they started negotiate for the property before they negotiate.
So that language was superfluous? The amendment was superfluous?
I don't think it governs this case. It governs future cases. In this situation, there was an obligation to provide it before they negotiated, and they did provide it before they negotiated. On page 85 and 86 of the appendix, Mr. Ramsey testified that they made an oral statement before making an offer, and that they gave him the report, Exhibit 3, before making the offer. So it happened in this case. Now, under these circumstances, there is a discrete component that is called for by the statute, and the trial court wrongly decided this is just part of the offer. It was made before the offer. It could not, therefore, have been part of the negotiation process because it was made before there was any offer in the case. Let me address one other issue.
If it was given before the offer, how do you ascribe it to the commission? I mean, I thought the whole idea of it being ascribed as an omission of the commissioner was because the statute says the commissioner's got to give you this as its good faith, you know, position as to what the property is worth. If they just say, hey, we had an appraisal done, take a look at it. Does that bind them to that?
Yes, sir. Well, it doesn't. Well, I mean, I'll take that back. It binds them to the extent that the statement becomes admissible as an admission. It doesn't bind them forever to say that just compensation must be this or must be at least this. They can, if they wish, bring in another appraiser to say, I think that the just compensation is only worth 92. But the original statement is admissible, and they can explain it away if there's a difference in those two things. I'm not arguing for a floor. I'm arguing for admissibility of a statement of admission by a party.
Well, when the appraised value is exactly the offer value, and the statute tells us clearly the offer value can't come in, the deposit can't come in, the amount taken out can't come in, wouldn't we be telling the legislature, well, we allow indirectly what can't be done directly?
I don't think so, because the statement doesn't have to be the same as the...
True, that would be a different case and a harder case. But if it's exactly the same and nothing changed between the offer, the appraisal was clearly written for the offer, was the offer, how could we say the appraisal comes in when there's 100 years of law that says the number doesn't come in and we just hadn't thought of this particular way of getting the number in?
There are two things I better say in response. One is I think that is this case. The numbers are different. The second is, under the circumstances of this statute, which the General Assembly has made mandatory,
the offer is different from the appraised value?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much different?
About $2,400. We can take a look at page 1 of the appendix. It shows the amount of certificate is $248,700.
But it was based on the Savage appraisal.
Correct. And then the appraisal itself is on page 90. It shows 246 and 292. So the numbers
but the Savage appraisal was the basis for the offer, and the Savage appraisal was given at the time of the offer.
It was actually given before the offer.
Okay, and there was no other appraisal at the time of the offer other than the Savage appraisal.
That's correct.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. May I have a brief time for response?
Yes. 5 minutes, 23 seconds.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Trevor Cox on behalf of the Commissioner of Highways. The Court should find no abuse of discretion with respect to either assignment of error. It should affirm for three reasons applicable to both assignments, which I'll quickly mention and then address in greater depth. First, the Virginia Code expressly prohibits the introduction of evidence of any amount represented by a certificate, that's 33.1-124H, and then specifically provides that that amount must be based on a bona fide appraisal, which is Virginia Code 33.1-120B. That the certificate of take must be based on the settlement appraisal. Clearly, the settlement appraisal is evidence of that amount. Second, the settlement
if the General Assembly wanted the appraisal itself to not be admissible, why wouldn't they have included that in the same sentence where they say that the certificate of take is not admissible?
Well, we believe that they did say that. They didn't have to spell it out for people to know what evidence of any amount represented by a certificate means. Second, the settlement appraisal
is not... So you think that by saying evidence of any amount, they don't mean evidence of the certificate of take itself, or are you saying that the appraisal, because it feeds into the certificate of take, is evidence of that, and so they intended to capture the entire water?
That's correct, the latter. That is evidence of the amount, and therefore is not admissible.
So suppose the earlier appraisal is different, completely different. A different number. And the director says, look, we're not going to go forward with this take with that number. That's clearly wrong. They didn't include the Oceana flight path, deduct, whatever. And a new appraisal is done. New appraisal is sent along with the offer, and the old appraisal is sent along with the offer, but they're not relying upon it. The old appraisal wouldn't be evidence of the amount of the deposit because it's not related to the deposit. So isn't the language you're focusing on being interpreted by you too broadly? Because if it meant exactly what you said, it would include everything, including completely unrelated appraisals.
So your hypothetical, Your Honor, is that if there are several appraisals that are conducted as part of the initial settlement offer package and are provided to the landowner...
Well, say you have $1 million appraisal. Later, people look at it and go, this is totally messed up. Get a new appraisal. You come back with $500,000 appraisal. Give the offer for $500,000. Both appraisals by statute have to be handed over during the process. Why wouldn't it be fair to say in that instance, well, look, we're not going to allow the 500 in, but the million appraisal has nothing to do with your offer, and we allow that to come in?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that the initial settlement appraisal becomes the settlement offer, and that the situation of having multiple appraisals beforehand is not common.
Well, counsel, what the appraisal that they're asking to get in is the $500,000 appraisal for the entirety of the land, not the certificate of take, which was the $240,000 that was actually paid into court. They're asking, as I understand it, to get in evidence that the entire property was originally appraised at $500,000 and later appraised at $200,000 or $190,000 or whatever the figure is.
Yes, that $500,000 figure, however, comes from the settlement appraisal, and that's, of course, what we're talking about.
Thought you just answered Justice Kelsey by saying that the appraisal amount was the amount paid into court. Or did I misunderstand you?
I think maybe, Your Honor.
Okay.
My response to Justice Kelsey was that
the appraised amount of the part taken.
Well, that is also, however, evidence of the of the certificate, because if you know that a certain amount of land is worth a certain value of money, you can calculate the amount of square footage and therefore calculate the value of the total property as opposed to the value.
Now, so let me ask you this: you seem to say that the appraisal is always going to be the amount of the offer, and that's not at all correct. In fact, one of the cases you cited, Fourth Circuit, WMATA case versus one parcel of land, stands really for the proposition that you can't introduce the offer, but in that case, the court says the offer includes the appraisal, the reasonable value, plus an increment to make the case go away. That happens a lot of times, doesn't it? The offer is higher than the appraisal.
My understanding is that it doesn't happen that often.
Why wouldn't it? You could save all the, your attorney's fees, I guess, and the people you hire as attorney's fees.
That's right, but we also have a responsibility to the Commonwealth to save expenses, save money. And so
settlements don't save money and save expenses?
No, but the initial settlement offer, we're talking about the initial settlement offer here, may well be just the appraised amount.
You don't want to bid against yourself, essentially.
Correct.
But would you say, I'll give you $10,000 more so you don't have to pay any attorney's fees? They'll save me that attorney's fees. It's like selling your house without a real estate agent, right?
There is a negotiation that takes place after that, but that becomes a different settlement offer at that point. The initial settlement offer is, my understanding, usually the same amount as the amount that it's appraised.
Would you agree with Mr. Emmert that this case is $2,400 more? The offer was $2,400 more than the appraisal.
Well, I can tell you how you get to that. The out of Appendix 1, you can see the fair value estimate is $248. And then the settlement appraisal, that's part of it that's included in the record, is at Appendix 90, and the fair value there is $246,292. The difference of $2,415 is a stipulated amount related to the value of the temporary construction easement, which was subsequently negotiated by the parties.
Well, do you think the General Assembly intended to exclude appraisals if they're the same amount of the offer, but not exclude them if they're different than the offer?
No, I think that, I'm sorry, would you repeat the question, Justice?
Do you think the General Assembly intended the statute to read so that if the appraisal is the same amount as the offer, we would exclude the appraisal because it's part of the offer some way, but if it's less than the offer, it wouldn't be excluded because it's not part of the offer?
No, because it refers to the fact that the amount is based on a bona fide appraisal, based on. I mean, I don't think the General Assembly would say, well, we'll give you half of that amount, and therefore it's based on the appraisal.
So based on to you means that means excludes the appraisal, because it's based on the appraisal.
Based on the appraisal.
Couldn't the General Assembly said that much more clearly if that's what they meant?
They might have, but the practice and understanding has been for decades that this is what it means. So not only does
the problem you have is no court's ever said that, and wouldn't it be a better exercise of judicial power to stand down and say, look, there's a lot of ways to read this. You didn't make it clear. You made other things really clear. But this is not clear. And until it's clear, we're not going to say it. Because the default in courts always is if it's relevant, it comes in. I mean, this is the policy of this Commonwealth since the beginning. Truth should prevail. Evidence generally promotes the search for truth. So if you start with that bias, which is a good bias, that if it's relevant and it's admissible, it should come in, and the party trying to keep it out has got the burden of persuasion and say why, and you don't have a case on point, your statute's not on point, you're making a daggone good argument as to the inference. But is that something we should be doing, is inferring things from statutes? Maybe we should just read them and just literally apply the way it says.
Well, I think you can read it literally and arrive at that conclusion, but to answer your honest question, I think there are at least four reasons why the proposed rule would be bad policy, bad law. First, it would eviscerate the principle of settlement confidentiality. That's sort of the backdrop to all this. The Ramsey's position has no limiting principle. If you can get in the value of the settlement appraisal, then I don't know what else would prevent introduction of other evidence in the settlement process. It would also change the dynamics of the condemnation proceeding below.
Well, the other evidence of the settlement would be the evidence surrounding the negotiations. This document was prepared and existed prior to the initiation of negotiations.
Yeah, Your Honor, I don't think it's a novel statement or particularly illuminating to say that the appraisal was conducted before the offer was made. Logically and statutorily, it must precede the actual presentation of the settlement offer because it's statutorily supposed to be part of the settlement offer package. It has to take place before. So I don't.
If you just use the normal common law, you know, settlement confidentiality principle, if something is pre-existing and it exists before there's the first word of settlement discussions, and you walk into a settlement conference, you and me, and we're in the conference room, and I go, look, here's why I'm not going to pay you anything. I dropped the thing on the desk. If that thing existed before our conference, I can't immunize it by mentioning it during the settlement, right? As a general principle. Isn't this case sort of like that?
I think it's different because here the Commonwealth has to conduct a proposal, the appraisal, and the settlement offer has to be based on that. And the appraisal has to be given to the other side. So it's not a case of a party trying to gain the upper hand early on, and then try to hide it later.
Okay, so let's look at it from a practical point of view. It seems to me that the rule that Mr. Emmert proposes makes a lot of sense, because on almost all occasions, I would suspect, the appraisal that you come to at the trial is going to be the same appraisal you had back then, so that the jury would find out about it. On those rare occasions when you come back with a lower appraisal, you've got your new expert to come in and explain, well, my appraisal is lower because of these reasons. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a fair way to approach this?
Well, it would certainly discourage settlement.
Why would it discourage settlement? Why? How would that happen?
Because why would a landowner want to settle the case when they think, well, I'm going to get at least that at trial, so we're going to push everything to the trial. And then even if the Commonwealth were able to...
Well, would that be a bad thing if that was a fair price that was offered, though?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If the appraisal was a fair price, what would be wrong with the landowner saying, well, that's the floor I'm going to get anyhow, because that's a fair offer?
Well, they have the opportunity to accept the settlement offer. They didn't here. They took a gamble. They took a risk. And the jury conducted an independent valuation. They visited the site. They listened to experts. And they came up with a lower value.
All that's well and good, but all they want is that chance to have that appraisal come into evidence. And have you explained why it was wrong?
Well, I think it would be unfairly prejudicial for the jury to be presented with possible inconsistencies in the Commonwealth's position that could have been, you know,
but they are inconsistencies. They are inconsistencies, right? How else can they get at them?
Change circumstances, mistake. These happen often in preliminary.
Fine, let the appraiser tell them. The second appraiser tell them.
I think it would be unfairly prejudicial for the landowner's counsel to be able to stand up in front of the jury and say, look what the Commonwealth is doing. It's a bait and switch when it's entirely just a mistake or changed circumstance.
Let me ask you a question about the amicus brief. Do you think that the Commonwealth owes a sort of a higher duty to these landowners who didn't want to sell their property in the first place? Perhaps it's a business they've built for years and land they've owned for years, and they don't want to give it to the Commonwealth, but they have to. Does the Commonwealth owe a higher duty to make sure they get a fair price?
Well, the Commonwealth certainly has to negotiate in good faith, and that's what was done here. They made a good offer. In fact, it was an offer that was higher than the value of the land. They made that offer, and the Ramseys chose to reject it. They decided to try their lot with cast their lot with.
Could the
with
under your logic, could the landowners have called Savage to the stand and just say, "Forget about the written appraisal. I want to ask you. I just want to know your personal opinion of this, that, and the other."
They might have. They didn't hear and made no attempt to do
but
that.
But assuming that they had, under your understanding of the law, would a objection to that be successful?
No, to the extent that they're using the prior inconsistent statement to impeach the witness.
Did
but
you
at
say
that
no?
time, Mr. Savage...
So it would come in?
It may well come in.
Then
well,
why are we
no,
fussing around with a case like this? Because it just means the next case they'll call the witness to the stand, which they didn't do here.
They may be entitled to do that, and I think that would be a battle for a different time. But what Mr. Savage would be testifying to then would be his opinion, and not the settlement offer, and not the appraisal.
If the rule would allow it to be used for impeachment, your position is it's not allowed at all because it would be highly prejudicial. If it's allowed for impeachment, why can't it equally be used as a party admission? What's the difference?
Well, it's a different set of principles. You have the statutory bar on introducing evidence of settlement offers, and also the case law bars the introduction of settlement offer evidence, and the statute bars the introduction of the certificate of take, but.
So the statutory bar is there whether you're using an evidentiary rule of allowing it for impeachment or one for an admission against interest.
Yeah, but there Mr. Savage would be testifying as to his opinion on a different matter. He would be testifying as to his opinion of the value of the land on the. You know, he wouldn't be able to testify to the value of the land on the date of acquisition, which is what the jury is supposed to take into account when they're assessing the fair value of the land.
Maybe I'm confused. What they wanted was the appraisal of the value of the land when the first appraisal was done. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So whether it's impeachment or whether it's admission, what changes? I'm
Well, I think there would still be strong objections to whether or not could be whether or not it could be introduced. I think that's a battle for another day, and I think it still would be unfairly prejudicial to introduce that. And I think that issue could be engaged.
Isn't impeachment not for the truth of the matter asserted, but simply for contradiction purposes? And a party admission would be an exception to hearsay, thus admissible on the evidence on the merits.
But excuse me, I see my time is up. May I answer?
Go ahead and answer.
A party admission is not admissible. A hearsay exception is not admissible unless the evidence is otherwise admissible. Thank you, Your Honor.
5 minutes and 23 seconds, Mr. Emmett.
I will try to give you some change back from that. I want to begin with what I believe is a very serious admission that the Solicitor General just made in response to Mr. Justice Kelsey's question about whether the statement would have been admissible if it were offered orally in court. He said it would. In that case, then the only difference we have is whether the statement is written or oral, and all the questions about whether it's evidence of the amount of the appraisal and so forth are now out of the case. I don't know that he wanted to do that. He's also argued to you...
But might not the difference be that if the individual was there, you could cross-examine him as opposed to just putting a document into evidence?
That is one of the differences, but the key is that Rule 2802, subparagraph 0, I think it is, says that admissions are outside of the scope of the hearsay rule. That means that you can introduce evidence of that, even though the proponent of the statement isn't in the courtroom. So that's really a non-difference at this point. He's indicated on a couple of occasions that the prejudice that would affect the Commonwealth if this were introduced. He made that argument at trial as well, and the trial court expressly rejected it, saying that he disagreed with the statement that it was more prejudicial than probative. That's at page 40.
Mr. Emmert, putting aside the issues of disclosure or non-disclosure under the statute, just under pure party admission law, in any case, you still have to lay a foundation, of course, for the party admission.
Yes.
Is that stipulated here? Or
I don't think that's
in
dispute because Savage was the person authorized to prepare the statement and the commissioner is the one who made the statement. As I said, I think it's page 7 of the reply brief. The speaker of the statement is the commissioner because the statute says that the condemnor shall make that statement.
So Savage, essentially you're saying that the foundation part of this case, party admission part of this case, is resolved by the statutory language itself.
I believe so, and I don't believe that there was ever any objection on that basis at trial. I don't think that the condemnor in this case ever contended that there was any problem.
So in theory, in another case, it could be some renegade appraisal out there that is not authorized, and there'd be a foundation dispute, but we don't have that here.
I think that's probably right. You could have something like that in a foundation issue. It didn't occur in this case.
That takes me back to my question to you when you were up here before, about the reason why I thought your position was that the foundation was laid because the statute requires the commissioner to attach this to their offer.
No, he has to prepare it and make disclose it.
Right.
And then begin negotiations. That's
right.
The statute says before initiating it.
And that's what makes it his admission.
Correct. The statute does require him to make that statement, and he's made that statement through the report that Mr. Savage prepared and that Mr. Williams approved, another appraiser. So there are two appraisers from VDOT who actually touched this. He's also indicated
that... So doesn't the statute require a floor then, going back to something you said earlier? I mean, isn't that the whole purpose of this?
I don't think that it does require a floor because a jury is always capable of expressing its own view. Now, let me assume that I'm wrong about one aspect of this. Let's assume that this... Well, no, actually, let me do it the better way. Let's assume that the case had been tried the way I think it should have been tried. And that the statement of... the property was worth $500,000 and just compensation was $246,000 had been at least given to the jury. But then Mr. Colorito came in and testified, and he did a really good job. And he said, I understand that this is what was originally certified, and it's wrong because of these three factors, and I'll show you exhibits. And he convinced the jury. Then I've had my trial. At least I've gotten the evidence in, and the jury, the finder of fact, has been able to decide who's more credible. But this trial court took away one of those components, took away relevant evidence because it clearly related to the issue in dispute in the case. Just compensation is the only issue being tried here. It was clearly material, and it was made by a party to the litigation, the Commissioner of Highways.
Mr. Emmett, a factual matter. Were you trying to get in, or the attorney at trial trying to get in the 246 figure, the just compensation figure, or were they just trying to get in the appraisal? And I ask because the court asked during the hearing, and I thought the lawyer said, that's all we want, Your Honor, is the $500 figure in response to the court's question.
All right. What you're reading from is a portion of the transcript that deals with after the trial judge has ruled the admission or exhibit 3 is not going to be admitted into evidence. And the lawyer said, I understand. It was marked as refused, and you'll see that on the court's record. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, the lawyer, in obedience to the court's ruling, is saying, then, you've told me I can't get the appraisal in. At least let me get in what he said was the value. He said $500,000, and that's what's on page 86 of the appendix. In this case, the commissioner invites you to make Virginia an outlier in American jurisprudence. You will be the first state court ever to rule that this language, which comes from a model federal act in 1970, means that the statement that's made before condemnation is actually the offer. We're never going to ask you to find that the offer itself is admissible, nor the certificate. But the statement is treated differently by the General Assembly, and that's why it should be treated here differently. I thank you for making, again, oral argument the most enjoyable part of my law practice.
The court will be in recess.
All rise.